Welcome to the fifth in a series we are calling L&D's Pivot to Performance, in which Guy Wallace and myself, David James, speak with esteemed guests about their own pivot from learning-focused practice towards performance orientation that more predictably and reliably, let alone efficiently and successfully, achieves demonstrable results for both employees and organizations. Over a total of seven sessions, each 2 weeks apart, we've invited guests that we know have made the pivot and have achieved real results from doing so. We'll invite our guests to share their stories, we'll question them on their approaches and encourage them to share relatable experiences to inspire you to either initiate or enhance your own pivot. And we'll also seek opportunities for you to get involved as well. But perhaps we should start with our own introductions, including our own pivot from a learning focus to performance focus. Guy, would you like to kick us off?
Thank you, David. Yes. So everyone, hello, my name is Guy Wallace. I've been in this business since August of 1979. I was one of the few that was very lucky in that from the very beginning, the people that I went to work with had a performance orientation, and they taught me the methods and approaches of the late Gary Rumler, Tom Gilbert, Bob Mager, and Joe Harless, some of the gurus from the past 60s and 70s and 80s, et cetera. So I was very lucky in that I didn't really have to make a pivot. I was kind of dropped into this performance orientation and served me well. I worked at two different companies back in 79 through 82. And I left Motorola in 82 and joined a small consulting firm. And my focus was to build an ISD, instructional systems design practice within the consulting firm. And I helped grow that. But the secret sauce to everything, in my opinion, is having this performance orientation. Whether you call it learning or instruction or training or now learning experience design, I think it's necessary for you, for all of us, to have that performance orientation to focus on what people have to do back on the job. And so I partnered with David in this series so that we could help share other people's stories and their journey in making the pivot to performance and how they're actually doing this. So I'm very grateful to our guest today and to David for co-sponsoring this with us.
Wonderful. Thanks, Guy. Just to add my own introduction and pivot. So I spent 15 years in-house in learning and development, with 8 years of those running learning and development for Disney at different levels in the UK and then Europe, Middle East and Africa. And but perhaps counter to Guy's experience, I became what I thought was a very talented and experienced trainer and training designer. But it wasn't until I reached my roles in Disney when no one was talking about learning and training, and they were talking about actual transformation and not the pithy version of such, but during such a disruptive period of between 2006 and 2014, I really was brought in to help entire organizations to either to pivot themselves or to merge. And we didn't rely on training courses, and we certainly didn't use e-learning for that. When it actually really mattered, we had to roll our sleeves up and run mini accelerated apprenticeships. But it required analysis up front, and it required us to finish our efforts with people being able to fundamentally do something different and often for different results. So that's why I think that it's absolutely critical that many people will join this profession and think it's one thing, then they'll get to another level and they'll realize it's another. And I think that that the stories that we'll be sharing with our guests throughout this will help to make this point. But that's enough about us. And it's time for this week's guest, Philip Lamb. Philip, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So nice to be here.
Thanks, Philip. Perhaps you could start off by giving us a short introduction to you and your background in L&D.
Yeah, sure. So I work at a Swedish bank called a fintech, a company called Klarna. I've been here for a little over six years now. Mm-hmm. Previous to that, I worked as a management consultant for a couple of years. So and while doing that, it was mostly focusing on developing leaders and developing salespeople. Those were the two areas where companies was willing to invest the most in the two cohorts. So for the last 10 years, I've been working at either equipping or developing people for international organizations, first externally and then internally for Klarna. I actually made the switch from being a consultant to doing it in-house because I wanted to see, to learn how hard it is to actually move the needle when you work for a company instead of drawing fancy PowerPoints and talking about strategy, but actually getting your hands dirty and actually make people better and talk to people and create stuff that actually changes stuff in an organization. And that requires so much more than just having this strategic approach. It actually requires you to do the work as well. So that's why I made the switch.
Yeah, wonderful, Philip. I think it can't be underestimated, the difference between in-house and perhaps the provider of services. In line with the title here of, L&D's pivot to performance, could you explain to us what your personal pivot to performance was, what was normal for you before, and what was your aha moment, if there was one, and what did that lead you towards?
Yeah, I don't think this was one aha moment. I think it's actually something that has been building inside of me throughout my time doing everything. I think I started working when I was 16, but for many years I actually did. So I did martial arts and I competed in Taekwondo. I trained with world champions, Olympic athletes, and when you train with people on that level, what I realized was that every single minute that we spent on training, we removed everything that had to do with self-defense or anything that didn't make you better at what you were supposed to do. We stripped out, and you could never slack when you train on that level. So I remember one moment where we were doing a combination, and in the last combination, we were supposed to kick the other person in the head, and we have helmets to protect the head when we do that, of course. But this person, my sparring partner, he didn't have a helmet. So what I did was that I stopped my foot just before I hit his head. And when I did that, he looked at me, he moved this close and started screaming and shouting in my face. And imagine that you're a 15-year-old training with adults, and he's screaming in my head. He says, "The next time you don't kick me in the head, I'll kick you in the head." And obviously this is not the environment that we want to create at work, but he was teaching me a lesson that you train the way that you want to perform. Mm-hmm. Right. And so having a performance oriented training is important everywhere. And then after that, I did two different degrees in university. So I did one in sports science and I did one in psychology. I worked as a designer for a while. I worked as a health consultant. I worked as an entrepreneur. I did everything. And from all of this, you sort of stitch together, like, how do you really learn when you do all of these things? How do you learn to do so many different things? And how do you get good at things? And, the one thing that I saw that was clear was that, one, it was possible to teach yourself these things through either mentoring or reading and using books and online resources. So it's possible to learn. That's one thing that you can believe that you can change the outcome for people. And then the other thing is that you need to be laser focused on what makes the difference. So when I worked as a consultant, that was the main job always. Go in there, find out what does the below average people, what do they do? What sort of behaviors, what sort of skills, what sort of mindsets do they have? And then the average people, what do they do? And then the top performers, what do they do? Do you know the difference between that? And unless you know those things, unless you ask for those things, you can never really build programs that is highly, highly targeted. Mm-hmm. And which means that you're creating something that you believe will have effect, but from an accountable side. So if you're a business leader, if you're someone who's trying to sell more or transform the business or doing anything, your first instinct isn't to improve somebody's resilience towards stress. It's actually the performance. And through understanding that, you are willing to invest in however much training is needed. Just like an athlete is willing to go to the workout session on a Monday because they know that this will lead to better performance. But if I told the athlete, okay, so you have an Olympic tournament in 6 months, let's watch some fun videos. Like, that's not going to work. Like, they know already 6 months ahead that every single minute is has to be planned. Some of it has to be training, some of it has to be performance, some of it has to be, like, they know all of that. But I think in L&D, it's seldom that we, like, I talk about, sometimes I talk about growing tomatoes. Like, if you're a farmer and you're growing tomatoes, and you're trying to, and you're trying to buy tomatoes, then you can decide, do I go to a farmer locally and ask them, can you grow the tomatoes? How long will it take? How much will it cost and so on? Or do you just buy it from another country? And the farmer will be able to tell you. But in L&D, often we cannot express what are we training for? Who are we training for? What will they be when we're done? If we train them, what are they? Can they actually do the job? And if we don't know those things, then who's willing to invest in it? I think so all of these things have taught me that, you know, if you, for example, work with salespeople and what you're providing salespeople isn't actually helping them close in sales, no one's going to want to take your training. Yeah. Nobody is going to think that it's important. But if you can show them and convince them that what they will do will improve their sales, they will fight for a spot in your training program. You don't need to convince anyone because they're gonna think it's unfair that you don't give them time now.
Yeah.
So I think if you have, that's because I worked with salespeople for a long time, it taught me that once you move to a central L&D position, that's sort of what you need to keep. You need to keep that laser focus on taking the strategy for the organization and then looking at translating that into human behavior. So what is it that we're asking people to do in order to move the entire organization towards the same way? Mm-hmm. And then looking at the delta. So the delta is, what is it that people are asked to do and what is it that they can do today? And then you train the delta. Mm. But if you don't know what the delta is, then obviously it's going to be very hard to decide how to prioritize, what to work on, and what to create. What should training be about? So I think all of these things have taught me to pivot to performance.
Yeah, brilliant. I think that there's so much great stuff in there. You know, that part about engagement that you're saying about people wanting to be involved in L&D, the way that I look at it is, it's not hard to convince 12 people every few weeks to attend a class. It's really not that hard. But so much digital is not involved with you know, it's not engaged with to any meaningful amount, because you can't convince a great deal of people to get involved in something if it isn't deemed valuable to them in the context of what it is that they're trying to do. And I think that there's a real mismatch there. I like the way that you've just described Delta. You know, there's so much of what Guy and I have talked about in this series and well before that, is that if you don't understand the performance problem or what it is that people are trying to do, then you have next to no chance of actually affecting that. And then what we do as NLD is that we seek unintended consequences to validate our intervention. Like, oh, it's just good to bring people together. You know, a minute spent training is better than no minute spent training. You know, it's absolute rubbish. But when it comes to analysis and discovery, I'm sure that you've refined your approach over your career. But could you share with us some highlights of what works for you, and then we can dive deeper into it in a moment?
Yeah, I think the diagnostic phase is quite similar to what it's like being a management consultant. So you can almost take the mindset of, if you're an L&D person, you can run the L&D organization as its own company inside a company. And if you cannot sell your services and convince someone to buy your services, then there's something wrong with how you provide your services. So So the approach that we're taking is that we've built sort of the same approach as a consultant would do. You come in, you listen, you ask questions, you do diagnostics. So I tell people that you are sort of more as a, imagine a personal trainer versus a bartender. So if you go to a bartender and says, hey, can you make me a whatever drink? And they'll just say, yes, I'll do it. But if you go to a personal trainer and say, I'd like to lose some weight, but I only have time for training 2 times a week, then that trainer won't tell you, yes, I'll do it. That trainer will tell you, no, you're out of your mind. Actually, you're going to need to listen to me. So they will challenge you. And it's the same way for L&D, where you're bringing some sort of expertise and you need to challenge the organization on what they think should be done. And you do it as a partnership. So you know, what we're trying to find out is, you know, first of all, should there be a training? Are they actually looking to improve some sort of behaviors? Do they know what great looks like? What happens if we don't do a training at all? I think there are so many already established approaches that you can just copy from different books. I think there's one episode with Sebastian Tindall in the first of the series where he also gives examples of some of the questions that he asked. And we use a similar approach. So we've just written down valuable questions that we would like to ask. But that's, I think that's not the hard part, but if you ask those questions and they are valuable towards the customer, then they will want to engage with you because they are trying to improve their performance. They know they are competing. They know they need to be better. They want to be better. It's not always that they think that the training is the solution. So if the training is the solution, that's what you need to convince them on. And sometimes what you need to challenge them on is the approach as well. Mm-hmm. Like in most of my meetings, I actually tell people that it's not training that you're after. You maybe they're trying to most approaches are that they have some sort of faulty process and they think training will solve their faulty process. Mm-hmm. So they say nobody does anything that with the way that we intended people to do. There's something people are being irresponsible. So we would like to train people to do the right thing. And being, you know, if you come from a background of psychology, you never think like that. You know that humans are irrational. So you design things around the irrationality. You don't train people the other way around. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned this from the reason I actually went into psychology was that Google said that they hire the most psychologists in the world. And the reason for that is that because they wanted to make their products human-centric and not the other way around. And so if you know that humans are going to act a certain way, then you actually need to change your process or your approach to fit humans, not the other way around. Mm. It's like, have you ever seen, if somebody had created a road like this, and then everybody just walks like this instead, because that's the closest distance. And nobody uses the grass. So there's the grass here in the middle. It just ruins the grass because everybody prefers this way. And there's someone who hasn't understood how humans work that have designed that road. So they end up just, you know, ruining the grass instead. Mm. And so for us, it's going into those discussions, trying to uncover what is the actual, what are the symptoms that they are seeing? What is the root cause to those symptoms? And how do you solve it? Is it by training people? And if you are training people, then we train people. We don't just think about information sharing. Mm. And you just go through that process of thinking about how do I take someone that doesn't know anything from A to B and think about the entire psychological process it takes for a human that are naturally resistant towards new information. Like we would. Mm. Like if I told you, you can never shop in your favorite store again, you have to find a different store and go somewhere else, that only that is difficult. Like, and then if you're trying to teach people new skills, of course, it's going to be hard. So you need to think very carefully about what is it that they need to learn first, second, third, and fourth, and so on. So all of that is sort of, we standardize. And the reason for standardizing is that, of course, that if you hire more people, change people, you need to be able to replicate your success. Mm. So for us, it's been very important to define what is the approach, what are the questions that we're asking, and what is the outcome that we're looking for. And then once we go into training mode and then start discussing how to design the training, every single person in the team also needs to understand what is the bar, like how are trainings done here so that we don't end up in completely different experiences depending on who's doing it.
Mm. What you just described there, as you said, you listened back to Sebastian's conversation, and your approach is similar in the analysis and recognizing the performance gaps. I wonder whether then there'll be value in us talking about how you do this at scale, because one of the challenges we get from this is when you move from a topic-centric approach to a performance or a human-centered approach, people look at that think if you're going bottom up, then you're taking individual learning needs, because they're coming from it from a learning and development, a traditional learning and development perspective. Top down means we need you to know this and we don't really need you to know your job. But bottom up, does it look like, I know that it's not, but you know, does it look like individual learning needs? It's not. But how do you scale your performance orientation?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. So that is a constant challenge when you're in an organization like ours that is in hypergrowth. Because when you're in hypergrowth, and we are growing headcounts 50% annually, and then you add on a natural attrition rate, then you can imagine how many people you need to hire every single year and how many new people are in the organization at any given point. And also, if you're in hypergrowth, then there's going to be new teams formed, new departments, and so on. And everybody's going to constantly wanting more support. So I think what most LMD teams can resonate with here is that you're going to feel, unless you change your approach, you're always going to feel that you're understaffed, under-resourced. You're always five steps behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of people will then debate, well, we need to prioritize. Do we optimize for quality? So we go in and do an intervention and we say no to things to keep focus, or do we do things at scale and we reduce the quality and we just think that, okay, everybody has to have do-it-yourself solutions instead. And there's a funny meme on the internet where, you know, people ask, should I buy an Xbox or a PlayStation? And the answer is yes. Like, you don't choose. Yes is the answer. So do we scale? Yes. Do we optimize for quality? Yes. There's no other choice. But if you do that, you sort of need to rethink how everything is done. And we take some inspiration here from companies like Tesla, because Tesla does a lot of things very different from the industry. It's the first car manufacturer that over 100 years has been able to mass produce cars. So in order to do that without going bankrupt, you actually need to rethink how you do everything and how you train people and what sort of culture you create. So if I take the Tesla has a car called the Model 3, which is their most popular car. It takes them 10 hours to produce one of these. And then you have Volkswagen, who is the world's largest car manufacturer and has loads of experience and resources in how to do this. It takes them 30 hours to make their smallest electric vehicle. Imagine being 20 hours faster than your most skilled competitor.
Mm.
I don't know how scared people at Volkswagen are, but they should be very, very, very scared when they see these numbers. And you know, when I thought about like, okay, so if we are under-resourced, if we are, how are we going to scale? And not only scale, but how are we going to compete then with companies like Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and so on? You know, for example, in 2018, these big tech companies, they spent $75 billion on R&D. And the US government spent $25 billion on going to the moon. So the entire Apollo program converted into today's money, that's $150. So in just 1 year, big tech spent half of the money that it takes for the US government to go to the moon. And then you think of like a small company like Klarna with 6,000 employees. How am I going to compete with organizations like that if we are competing against the biggest tech companies? So the, when you ask me how do we scale, we have to, of course, rethink every single step in how we do our trainings. First of all, the standardization was highly important in order to build the blueprint and the DNA in what makes a good training. So we do that, and then we test and we iterate that approach, knowing that, okay, so if we follow this every single time with the same recipe, will it create a good training? And then we measure the actual outcome. So whatever the training is supposed to do, does that really happen? Mm. And the answer was a resounding yes. So we know that we can, now we can replicate it. And then the other thing is that how do we do things at scale? And we thought about, obviously we knew that we had to use technology somehow, because we cannot, unless we have superhumans, there's no way that I can use humans to compete with the big resources. So I need to use technology and in a smart way somehow. So what we looked at is that we look at what is the natural behavior in your organization. And if you're in a hypergrowth organization, you're going to hire a lot of smart people and ambitious people. And what's the default behavior for them is to create a lot of documents. So whenever they need to share something, convince someone, jot something down, they'll document it. They'll do PowerPoints, they'll do documents. So we know that there is a natural behavior already existing in the organization to target performance somehow that is not being leveraged by L&D. So the first solution we must do is to tap into those resources, which is exactly what we did. So we bought we acquired an LMS that focused on simplicity, and where the solution itself was so intuitive and worked just like a document editor. So if you know how to use Google Docs, you know how to use this tool. So that we knew that if we made that happen, then people were also able to create the trainings together with us easily, without us having a huge content creation team. So the only way for us to do that is to have people in the organization support us in this journey to create performance-related training. We would consult them and advise them, and they would do the actual creation. We would focus on creating the best ones. And when we went in, we wanted to make sure that these are going to be our flagship model version of trainings, which will inspire everyone of what can this actually do. But the simplicity of the tool and the platform, meaning that everybody else could do it, was one key in the step. The second one was that we had to retrain people in the team to think of the platform almost like account managers. So not thinking about them as L&D people only, but you are now responsible to grow the platform. So now we bring in product management and growth hacking into the place. So the more time in the early stages, we can make sure that this implementation grows, and every single conversation we have with the suppliers and with our internal teams is how to get people onto the platform so that the platform becomes the default behavior to use when they need something. And this worked really well, and also because we thought about the next step after this. So you have a natural behavior to create content already. We tapped into that by buying a platform which enabled this, and then we thought about the next step is the hardest part for most people, which is distribution. And distribution takes a lot of time, because when you have attrition and a lot of people joining, it means that you need to keep track of who has the document, who has access, who's doing what, are you following up with people, are you collecting feedback from everyone? This takes a lot of time from L&D. So all of these things, if you think about from start to finish, if we only have very little resources, we need to think about how do we automate as much as possible. So I think the platform that we acquired, which is Loop, helped us. We saw that we could get all of these features in place so that we could focus on constantly innovating our approach, innovating the way that we deliver content, and spend more time with our stakeholders and with people in the organization to scale this instead of being stuck in content production and collecting feedback, doing admin, all of those things completely automated. And so, you know, when I look at, when we do a new training now, and we did a training recently where the content creators took some bold chances and created some stories that we knew this might not work. And some people loved it, a lot of people hated it. But the speed in order in which we were able to launch the training, automate the feedback so that the first people that completes the training already gives us feedback on what works and what doesn't work. And then us being able to rework the entire training and then launch a new version and collect new feedback and knowing that the new version works, that can be done within 2 weeks. And so you have, so you know that every single time you launch something, however it's going to go, it's going to work because of this, these mechanisms. And that's only, I think that's an example of how we use technology to its maximum. Another, you know, another thing that we had to do, of course, is that even doing all of this, it's never enough. And we've since been able to hire much more people to the team. And still it's not enough because now the organization sees the success of the platform. So, and that spreads. So now more people want to work with us. So from, I think in 13 months, we went from having 50 trainings in our platform to 1,950. And that's with two people in the team. And that's a staggering amount of content production focusing on trying to target what makes the difference in performance in for each individual. So it's not general training. It's like for salespeople, it's sales related. For engineers, it's engineering related. Like it's training that is targeting what you do at work. And if you're doing that, you need to do it for everyone. You can't just be saying, well, for the next 8 months, I'm going to work with the sales team and no one else is going to get support. So you need to find, that's why it was so important to do all of this so that we could support everyone at the same time. But even doing all of this, you still, like there's so much demand now that there's no stopping in, first of all, how many people I need to hire, but also how many people are trying to work with us. So we thought, you know, what makes the difference? And it's the conversations that we have with our clients that makes a difference, that makes them think. So, okay, so we cannot remove that. We have to be in that room to discuss those things. But how many other things that are related to the LMS or anything else that can be more scalable? So we created something that we call a masterclass. And instead of meeting with a stakeholder one-on-one, we just thought, let's bring them all into the room at the same time and work with all of them at the same time and see how that goes. So now we had 17 people in the same room at the same time. And we create a little scalable content that's being automated into a program in Loop. And then we spend time on the steps that makes a difference for the training. And now, you know, it's gone 10 weeks and we can launch 17 training programs instead of one at a time. And then that this then becomes a community of people that has been trained that can now spread that knowledge and spread, you know, the idea of creating performance related content. And this just it's just another example of how we constantly try to think about how can we do more with the same amounts or with just slightly more resources.
Yeah, wonderful, Philip. Would, at this point, before I move forward, I would like to invite any questions that just in case those joining us do have. But just to before we do, Philip, just to clarify, you're bringing 17 business people in, stakeholders, and they're coming in to talk about what's really important to them. They're not coming in to talk about learning. But what you've been able to do is grow your team whilst you're automating. Again, let's address one of the fears here that when work is automated, then there's less work for the humans. What you're saying is the more you've automated and the more time you've saved, that has elevated the status of the human beings and you've been able to grow the team. Have I got that right?
You're absolutely on point. I think it's also more fun for the people that work in your team. So if you're an L&D professional and you are doing admin today, and you're imagining a world where you're doing much less admin and spending more time doing difficult stuff, it makes you more valuable. It makes you more valuable towards the team, towards the organization, and you can focus on complex things that cannot be replaced by a robot. And everything else is automated. There's not many downsides to automation. I haven't heard from anyone, I wish we didn't have automation so that I could do it instead. I've never heard that from anyone. And I, you know, since we didn't have any sort of automation 13 months ago, now there are over 140 automations running in the background every single day. So every single thing that a human would need to do, 140 of them a robot is doing every single day, and it's also increasing.
Yeah, brilliant. So Philip, it goes here. Don't be frightened of automation. It's eliminating your admin and elevating what your humans are there to how they add the most value. I think that's fascinating. Guy, do we have any questions?
Yes, we do. Some of those you've already answered, Philip. Somebody was asking what LMS you're using, and Loopit was your answer, I believe. Another person asked about, have you considered user-generated content? And I think you answered that as well, in that the answer is yes. A new question just popped up here. Have you managed to redefine learning with your clients and learners? Many still both assume it's a need and define the solution in advance. They come to you and ask for training or learning. And I think you talked a little bit about that, but so how do you standardize your approach, which was the question I was asking, because a lot of people are afraid of standardized approaches. So you're working with your stakeholders, you're working with content, people to help you you develop content. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think in terms of could you repeat the last part so that I'm just clear about what I should answer first?
Yeah, that's this is a question from is asking, when you're working with your stakeholders and they come to you and they've asked for training, you know, or learning, you know, how do you work with them in that? Because the answer may not be training or learning. It may be the process of that, and they need to fix that. So can you talk a little bit about the working with stakeholders when they presume the solution?
Yes. It's the same. So it's just asking those questions. So if I take the latest one where somebody said that a lot of people don't know how to use the travel management system, and so they are sending a lot of questions to the team to ask if, you know, they can approve a lot of travels, while in reality it's just that the closest manager approves the travel and then they can just book it, and they wanted to create a training and send everybody to that training so that people felt comfortable booking. And I said that this isn't your problem, isn't really training related. And we just went into depth of talking about, you know, the reason why people are asking the questions isn't because they are, it isn't because they're stupid. It isn't because they are lazy. It's because of just human convenience. When you're in that situation, when you want to do something, you just want to be able to do it and get the confirmation that you want. Is this okay to book this? And what's the fastest way of doing it? And the fastest way of doing it is to email the people that you can see on the screen that are responsible for whatever you're working with. And so, and what they can relate to is that the company Klarna is built on convenience. Like, our entire product exists because it's more convenient than other alternatives. And so they can relate to that. And so they understood that, okay, so if I do a training, which means that when somebody gets to that stage, they have to jump out, do the training, then come back and then book the travel, it's not going to happen. So if you can paint that picture, nobody's going to think, Okay, let's invest time. Let's all get together, invest a lot of time, and create a training that doesn't solve the actual problem. So what's going to happen instead is that you need to provide the learner with that information in the right time when they need it, and that's going to remove all the questions. So if they can get that when they need it, they're not going to ask you the questions.
There's another question here about how did you get your colleagues who are super busy with their operational work in a hyper-growth company to contribute their time to generate learning content?
Oh, that's an excellent question. We had no idea that it was going to be, I have to say, it exploded. We had very big ambitions, but the way that it's being received is beyond our, you know, our wildest ambitions even. And I think it comes back to what I talked about before, which is people join a company like Klarna from all over the world. So there are people from over 80 different nationalities that work in this company. Some of them move, you know, when I started, somebody had moved from Silicon Valley to Stockholm. So he worked in Silicon Valley on a Friday, and on Monday he was sitting next to me in Stockholm. And you don't do those things just to, like, you do that because you care about your career and you want to be able to perform. So when you tell people that, hey, we are not going to create anything that feels like a burden for anyone, like, all we are trying to do is that whatever you as a business leader is trying to communicate to your organization, the things that you want your people to do, we will help you translate that into words and into a training. That's it. And who wouldn't want to do that? So if you're running a team, if you're running an organization and you want everyone to be better, if you could find a way to document what you want to convey, what you want people to do, wouldn't you do that? Wouldn't you want to be able to do that? I think one example of something that can be super powerful is there's a training called, it's just a document, but somebody in an organization 15 years ago got tired of all the bad product managers that existed in his company. So he created a document that he called good product manager versus bad product manager. And said, this is what a good product manager does, and this is what a bad product manager does. And that was so good that that document has lived on for 15 years. And it has no pictures. There are no things where you need to move one thing from one side to the other side and match them. And there are no videos to watch. It's just a simple, concise document on what someone does to do a good job and a bad job. And that's all you need. It's hyper-focused on performance, which is why everybody loves it, which is why it's lived on for 15 years, even though the world has changed in these 15 years. So if you understand how to get the DNA of actual performance, you don't even need a picture.
Yeah.
You just need the actual content. And that is the same as what your super busy operational leaders are doing as well. They are trying to think about, how do I elevate the business? How do I leverage everyone's performance? How do I get everyone involved? It's through communication. And your training can be that strategic communication that they need. If it focuses on closing that delta, that, you know, accelerate that gap that exists, with addressing the skills and behaviors that somebody needs to focus on.
Great.
One last question, if we might, this might be a short one. What are the cons of the convenience you have created? Is there any downside?
Well, it depends on if you like to work a lot or not. The one downside is, so last year I had, I had two people in my team, and when I was catching up with David before we did this session, you know, I had four teams and 30 people, and the amount, you know, when we're thinking and planning about the amount of people I was going to hire for the coming 4 years, the organization, the feedback that I got, that I think you should double that number. The number that I put in, that what I thought, this is ambitious, it doubled that number. So I think when you do something that is well received, and you can show, I think it's not just well received because everyone can pick up any book about performance consulting and run with it, but can you execute on a very high level? Just like my example with Tesla, like, can you organize the team? Can you standardize? Can you showcase a high executional capability? Then why wouldn't you invest in that? And I think that's, you know, the downside is just like everything is so much bigger now and so much more complicated. So it's fun. It's super fun, but it's obviously it's more work for sure. Mm.
Great. Philip, people are going to be at different stages of this. And, you know, this is the fifth in our series here. And it's always important about how people will apply a performance orientation within their context. And as we've heard from Sebastian and Anne-Marie and from Dawn and from Ken before, it does, you know, it requires a different approach and it requires an understanding of the context. What suggestions do you have for others who be live with us today or watching the recording? What suggestions do you have for them in adopting or adapting their current approach?
Yeah. I think one is to decide that you want to try it out. Because once you decide, you will need to focus. And if you have never done it before, if you don't have any experience of doing it, you will actually need to upskill yourself, of course. So just the fact that, I guess that if you're listening to this, you're actually interested in doing it, in doing a pivot to performance. I think that decide that you want to do it. And it doesn't take much. You can basically do this tomorrow. Sign your first, or just download the first questionnaire for diagnosing and doing a needs analysis. And try it out and see what sort of feedback you get and adapt your approach to fit your style. And as you get better, you'll see that the response is going to be as good as well. So, I mean, we have this, I'm going to go with the Nike slogan, just do it.
Brilliant. And that's what we've heard pretty much from everybody. You don't have to wait for the culture to change. You don't need CEO buy-in. You don't need line managers to support it. All you need to do is have a different conversation at the outset about the work itself, about performance and results rather than learning. And then it becomes much more apparent what needs to happen because you're speaking with the stakeholders about what's important to them. Guy, do we have any more questions coming through?
Oh, we do have one, a couple actually. So does Klarna provide recognition and rewards for people contributing to the learning content development efforts? People not inside your department, but the other people that are contributing? You do?
I think it depends, not on a global level, but it is something that we expect from everyone. It's part of, especially if you're quite senior, then it's, you know, we design it in every competency framework, it's, you know, coaching and sharing and making other people better is part of the job. And if we actually help them scale that, it makes their job easier.
Very good. So somebody said that based on your answer to the cons for convenience, long hours and working above and beyond, how are you incorporating wellness and balance within your workforce?
Yeah, I think... It really depends. And I think the culture as such isn't that you are supposed to do long hours and weekends and so on. I think it's more about the intensity of the work, not that you're working weekends and long hours. I think what's good is that there's, and obviously if you're the type of person that has a hard time restricting your working hours, there's support in place for that as well. But I think it's more in the culture that it's okay to go home after a certain time. And it, being a Swedish company, work-life balance is super, super important. But then it's also hard because the people that we employ come from all over the world. And sometimes they are so hardworking that it's hard. I'll give you one example where I gave my employees a day off for free, and they still worked. And then you tell them to stop working, and they don't do it. So sometimes they don't even listen to you. But it's just because I think when the work is super fun, super engaging, and you can see a lot of impact of what you're doing, people get excited. It's you know, this means something to them. It's something that they will cherish and carry with them in their career.
Are there other systems that you're using besides Loop?
We use Loop as our main LMS, and then we can add on other systems, which we do as well. So we add on other systems to, for example, provide certifications or something like that. But we use Loop as the main system, main access points for everyone.
Somebody has recognized a book in the background behind you, but the question generally is, what performance related books would you recommend? And I'll extend that to what people or other resources might you identify for people that have had an impact with you and in your efforts? What would you recommend to other people as a startist?
Well, Guy, I know you have published a lot of books, so maybe we can now you can plug that in as well. And then, David, you have a lot of things published as well. So obviously, I think the latest book that I read that I thought was really, really good, is called, and perhaps this is the one that people saw in the background, Driving Performance Through Learning. And actually, you can see there's a commentary from David.
Get everywhere.
Yeah. That one's really good. It's a good starter. I'm an avid reader, so I read tons and tons of books and articles. But, you know, just start with one. That's it. If you don't know one, just start with one, or just Google performance consulting best books and pick the first one on Amazon, and that's how you get started.
Any more, Guy, to finish off, or is it time to wrap up?
I think that there's just some nice comments in the chat area that, it's scrolled by me right now. But basically, if you're doing good work, you're going to get recognition. You're going to get the support of your organization, which I think is the key theme. Don't ask permission. Just go ahead and start doing this. Start somewhere and get some results, and those results will help build your reputation of your capability to do this kind of work, and the demand will grow.
Mm. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, completely agree. There's no downsides to starting off having a very different conversation. But Philip, this has been fascinating. We can tell by the amount of questions and comments that we've had so far that it's been hugely appreciated. And thank you, everybody, for your input and for joining us today. We'll make the recording available on YouTube and on Guy's channels as well. And so we'll be sending out an email with a link to that, if not tomorrow, then certainly later on this week. We have one more session with a guest, with one guest in 2 weeks' time with, tell me if I've got the name wrong, Guy, Steve Villachica.
That's it.
Yep. Okay, great. 2 weeks today. And we've got one final session in which we're inviting a panel back. We had some feedback, and somebody asked us, could we have a conversation rather than simply asking some questions? So we're going to be doing that on the 15th of December. So we'll let you know again via email, and you'll be able to sign up for that. Thank you very much again for joining us. And we'll hope that you'll be joining us in 2 weeks' time for the last two sessions. Thank you very much. Thank you, Philip, again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.